Now. Real people, real opinions. Nighttime Talk with Niall Boylan.
Ireland's classic hits radio.
Last night I spoke to Derek Byrne, who's running for the Shannon in TCD. And out of obviously our own, not only our obligations, but it would be nice to hear other voices as well running in the same place in TCD. We decided we'd chat with some other candidates. The Shannon, of course, is the upper house of the Oireachtas. It's a unique chamber with members coming from various panels representing different sectors across society, including culture, education, labour, agriculture, industry, commerce, and of course the university panels. Unlike the Dáil, the Shannon, of course, you don't get to vote. Instead, it's made up of individuals nominated by the Taoiseach, elected by the university graduates and chosen by members of the Oireachtas and local authorities. Also, if you're an academic, you get to vote. There's about 70,000 people will be voting in this particular one for TCD candidates. But today I have some of those candidates on the line ready to share their visions, their policies. And joining us is Marcus Matthews and also Adi Adi Oblabaroda, who is also joining us as well. You're both very welcome. I do apologise, Adi.
That's fine, thank you.
And I hope I got it right in the end, by the way. I do hope I got it right in the end.
Well, you'll get used to it.
Anyway, listen, thank you very much indeed. I will be joined by two more candidates as well after midway through our second break as well, just to give us a chance. I didn't want to have four people on the air at the time. It's too many voices. That's okay on TV when you can see people shouting at each other. But on radio, it doesn't work quite as well. Marcus, let me come to you first. Ladies before gents. I suppose the first thing, the best thing to do would be set out your stall. What made you want to run for the Shannon? And, you know, what could people expect from you? And what are the things that you're really passionate about?
Thank you. So, I mean, why I'm running for this election is because of my experience from my home country, original home country in Nigeria, and the over 20 years of living here, the things I have experienced. So it's about my lived experience, about my and what I've observed, and where I feel that I might be able to contribute to make life better for the people of Ireland. So my background, my educational background, I mean, born into the family of two teachers, education has always been my passion. Mm-hmm. And I have spent most of my adult life studying, and I'm still studying, even though I'm working as well. So when I came here, I, of course, first thing was to get a job. I was working full-time, but at the same time, I was studying part-time and raising my children at the same time. So this experience is very useful for me to be able to participate in having appropriate legislation in place that will support mature students, returning students, parents who have to go back to education, families. Mm-hmm. And students in general.
Nothing better than having a good mammy, by the way, in the Shannon, who understands the family. And I suppose that's what's important. You also are a barrister of law as well. Now, are you a barrister of law? Did you train to be a barrister here or in Nigeria?
No, in Nigeria, I studied biology and microbiology. It was when I got here. It was while I was working in the Department of Health in 2014 that I enrolled in Kingsland's part-time.
Mm. Okay.
So it's always been work full-time, study part-time all the way since I've gotten here.
Okay, well, now hold on a second, because I just want to give you both the equal amount of time just to set out your style before I start asking a couple of questions, maybe some difficult ones too. Marcus Matthews, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Marcus, set out your style there if you want to. And why do you think those 70,000 people, well, realistically, probably only 15,000 will vote, but why do you think 70,000 people should vote for you?
Yeah, so first off, thanks for having me on, Niall. And I suppose, I mean, look, to answer to your question, why run? I mean, I've been 25 years, been told, you know, we're going to fix, you know, housing, health, energy, climate, transportation, the big things that we've really struggled with for a long time.
Struggle is probably an underestimate. I'd say we failed miserably.
I'm being polite, and I try to always be polite in terms of, you know, when I'm talking about policy, when I'm sort of, you know, presenting how we can get these things done. I suppose over those 25 years, I would have seen, in the public affairs industry and the sort of policy industry, like a lot of, ideas come forward, consortiums come forward with really brilliant, you know, big picture solutions for, you know, deep offshore wind or, energy storage, or, you know, how to do more affordable housing or transportation options. And, you know, it was obvious to just, you were sitting there listening to it on the radio, or you're watching it on TV, or you're at maybe a talk or something like that. And it was like, oh, wow, this is so obvious. It's going to definitely get implemented. And it was always the same thing from, you know, the public sector or the politicians. So I was like, oh, that's very interesting. And you sort of just see these things just breeze on by and nothing would happen. And the problem would just get worse. And it was always like, oh, yeah, well, we have to figure out how to address these things. And, yeah, we'll work on it and we'll. But nothing's ever happened. It's just always gotten worse. The problems have got bigger and there were no solutions. And we're still using, you know, fossil fuels to power the country when we've one of the largest offshore areas and wind capacity in Europe, for the world. So it's sort of, there seems to be a lack of I don't know, politicians or people who come through who maybe are aware of these solutions and are willing to pick up and drive them and hold them.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, well, I'll start with that first. I'll come back to you, Marcus, with that first. When you talk about there's a lack of politicians who want to tackle climate change, who want to, you know, rid the world of fossil fuels, and I'm not suggesting the world won't be rid of fossil fuels. At some point in the future, it certainly will, and we all know that. You know, it's a dying fuel. But here's the thing. The Green Party were practically annihilated, not only in the local elections, in the European elections, by the way, obviously I was involved in that, skin in the game, but also in the general election. So it does seem that the general public, although have an appetite for the environment and want to protect the environment, when it comes to climate policy, they're tired of it. They're tired of being taxed. They're tired of life being made difficult for them. They're tired of those kind of policies that are upsetting their lives. So what makes you think that, you know, that's going to change?
And you're absolutely right. And I spent the last 5 years looking at these, you know, and I'm going to be blunt, twits. You know, we got carbon taxes, we got cycle lanes, we got bottle tax, we got utterly petty things. And you're sitting there and you're kind of going, what the hell is wrong with these people? Why aren't they doing large scale wind? Why aren't they doing large scale photovoltaic projects, which, you know, there are those now coming into Ireland, they're viable. Where was the geothermal energy? I mean, these things have been around for a long time. There's been many different consortia that have come and gone and tried to do this, you know, approach government down to 25 years with cash solutions, construction crews ready to go. And they just, nothing happens. They just looked, oh, no, well, you know.
Well, Eamon Ryan promised everybody, you know, that we'd all get our A-rated houses eventually. We'd all be upgraded. But sure, people can't afford to do it. It's all well and good offering people a grant, provided they're willing to trump up the money in the first place. And people just can't afford it. You know, Mary, who lives in Crumlin in our 50-year-old council house, you know, she can't. She lives on her own. She can't afford to have her house insulated.
And wait for
a grant.
It's not on individual people. And that's where I, you know, especially over the last 5 years, looked and go, what's wrong with these politicians that they keep lumping it on, you know, the ordinary person, lumping it on the end user? It's not their problem. The cost shouldn't be falling on them to fix these things. Mm-hmm. You know, and at the end of the day, if you want to tackle climate change, you've got to look at the energy. Like, there's no point in having your bottles and your bottle tax when you're there burning gas and up until not that long ago burning peat to generate your electricity when you're sitting there in one of the windiest places in Europe, you know?
Let me go to Addy and let me just move away from climate policy if I can, because Addy, I wanted to talk about the cost of living. Because realistically, when you go into the Seanad, if you look back at the debates over the last year or so in the Seanad and what has been debated, and Marcus outlined a few things there that we failed miserably in, you know, which is healthcare and the cost of living, housing, immigration. These are all the hot button topics at the moment. And of course, free speech, which was debated quite a lot, by the way, in the Seanad last time around, and probably next time around coming up to when they try to bring in the legislation again, if they do try to bring it in. So Addy, what are we going to do about the cost of living? Because the government seems to be ignoring the fact that people just cannot afford to live in their own city anymore, or cities.
Yes, I mean, the problem with the cost of living is a major issue, and it's one of the key areas that I'm looking at. Of course, when salaries are increased, automatically there will be inflation because prices go up when people have disposable income to spend. So it's not just about increasing salaries. I think the important thing to do is, first of all, the government has to find a way to bring down the cost of purchasing items, maybe by reducing VAT And so first of all, the price of things must come down as opposed to increasing people's salary. Maybe taxes, maybe there could be tax incentives for some expenses. So those would be something that needs to be done.
Would you agree with privatization, for example, in relation to, say, energy companies and capping the prices, or possibly privatization, which I know we went down that road many years ago, but would you agree with, you know, capping energy prices? Is that something that you've ever thought about, or do you think that would fail?
I think the best way to approach energy and prices, I think it would be like a model of a public-private partnership, so that it cannot be left in the hand of the private operators alone. Otherwise, it will be commoditized, and capping it might not really help. So we need to look at the sustainable ways of generating energy and power in a way that is cost effective. It will be research dense, and it's not my exact area of expertise right now. But looking at the overall what can be done, it will be generating it in a way that is more cost effective. For example, and this is just one thing I'm mentioning, nuclear energy is the government of Ireland, they've really closed their mind against that. But France, 80% of energy in France is generated
nuclear.
Through nuclear energy, mm-hmm. and it's cheaper, more cost effective, and it's not as the pollution and all that, it's lower. The research is still ongoing, and
it's not a bad suggestion. I mean, maybe I could just throw that quickly to Marcus as well. It seems Marcus has a huge interest in that. Marcus, in relation to nuclear power, it's something that we kind of seem afraid of. Sorry, I said privatize earlier on. I should have made the opposite way around. But Marcus, in relation to nuclear power, we kind of have this fear of nuclear energy. It's cheap. There isn't that much waste. Yes, the waste can be dangerous if it's not disposed of properly. But generally speaking, it's safe. I know we have had our accidents in the past, but I think we're past that point. Is it? I mean, France are doing well out of it. Is it not for us?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I will say, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I obviously, I mean, just to point out, I'm the only candidate running that has produced a genuinely original multi-issue platform across 15 sections of policy. So it's interesting how other candidates, as this election is going on, I'm getting asked these questions. You know, suddenly maybe they're starting to say things that are in my platform. So I've covered nuclear energy in my platform. It's something I've been, say, over the last 6 years, have changed my position on, because there's been a new generation of nuclear reactor that's come through, which is, you know, fundamentally a step up on multiple fronts. It's far safer. It's far more efficient. You know, it's designed to operate on a smaller scale, so-called pocket reactors. It's really ideal for a country like Ireland. We could put it in, it could address our what's called base load requirement. So when the wind is kind of not blowing exactly the way we want it, we definitely would have the power that we need. The waste side of it, you know, yes, you're correct. It doesn't produce a huge amount of waste. However, I'm one of those people that believes just because it doesn't produce a lot of waste doesn't mean we shouldn't go hell for leather on a global effort in terms of research and development on that question. And that's something I would sort of be stipulating. If we're going to do that, we've got to get stuck into it. Now, I was chatting there, I think it was with the Provost of Trinity, I think maybe the nomination ceremony, and I was saying, you know, this is an area where our research and development economy, we could get in on that and really drive. I mean, there's nothing.
I mean, it's a small country. We wouldn't need that many reactors to power the whole country, for God's sake.
We'd need one. One.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's a small country. Okay. Let me just move back to Addy again. Addy, you know, I know you're an advocate as well for marginalised communities. Immigration, of course, is a big topic in this country. You know, it doesn't seem like every second week, well, certainly before Christmas in 2024, there was a protest of some description. We seem to have lost control of our immigration policy. Where do you stand on immigration policy? Do you agree with deportations? Do you believe we should change the system we're currently using, because it seems to be a mess? Where do you stand on our immigration policy?
Okay, thank you. I am in support of the European Immigration Pact, because it will help, because based on that, we don't actually have to take in any more asylum seekers. physically, we could rather contribute financially.
Yeah, but we'd have to pay. But if we don't take them, it means we have to pay.
Yes, because it's better to pay at this rate. I mean, there is globally, there are disasters.
That can be quite expensive, Addie. Sorry to question you. That can be quite expensive. If we're turning away every asylum seeker and we have to pay the equivalent of $25,000 per year to another country.
Can you let me explain properly? So we have disasters, natural disasters, and worldwide, and we have people fleeing from conflict zones. The number, the percentage, 70% of people who are fleeing from areas of conflict, they are actually absorbed within the locality of the area. So only 30% of people fleeing war and disasters actually get to Europe. So the war we are complaining about is a very minority percentage of the people who are actually the real people who are actually in need of refuge.
Would you accept that many of the people coming to Ireland, many do need our help and support and should get better support, there's no doubt about that, who are genuinely fleeing war and persecution. But would you agree that our system is broken and flawed
and people
are taking advantage of it and they're coming here as economic migrants, which was never the plan?
And I am totally, yes. And that is where I stand. So there are genuine asylum seekers and they are economic migrants.
Should economic migrants, this is the question that has been asked of Helen McEntee on many occasions, and she seems to fail miserably in having numbers or facts and figures to back her up, should they be deported?
Look, we have...
Addie, that's a simple yes or no answer, isn't it? If you're not a genuine asylum seeker...
You're asking me a question and you're not giving me a chance to answer. It's important that you let me
really
answer.
I don't really want to explain, though. It is a yes or no question. Yeah. And I'll take the question now.
Okay, I know. I get Marcus, I'll give you an opportunity a second to ask the same question. And Addie, to be fair, I'm very stuck for time, obviously, because I'm limited because of two more people coming on after you. But, I mean, it is a simple yes or no answer. If somebody's coming to Ireland and they're a genuine asylum seeker, I think we all accept they should get as much support, if not better support, because what they're getting at the moment, a tent in Mount Street or whatever it happens to be, is certainly not adequate and it's inhumane. But if somebody is coming here with no identification, they're not a genuine asylum seeker, they're coming from Birmingham or something like that, which they've been in the last 6 months, applied for asylum in maybe seven different countries, but they're actually an economic migrant, should they be deported? They fail the system.
If we don't need them. We have workforce shortages, okay? So, as Derek, we need to tighten our own procedure. When they come in, if there are industries and sectors where we have shortage of workforce, as they come in, they need to be sent straight to social welfare department, or we might create a department for jobs. So when they go in, they go straight to the available job. So it's about utilizing them, their economic migrants.
So you're saying no. You're saying no. You're saying people shouldn't be deported.
I'm not saying.
Well, you
no.
are.
I'm
you just said they should be sent to. They should be sent to jobs. There's always jobs available.
No, I'm saying that if we don't need them, there is no point that we're having shortages of workforce.
Okay.
There are people here. If we don't need them, if there is no job for them to do, then they need to return. They need to be returned as quickly as possible and as cost effective as possible. I am not in support of economic migrants abusing the system and posting to be asylum seeker. I am totally against that.
Okay, Addie, hang on, please. I'm really stuck for time. I have to be fair to everybody. Marcus, in relation to immigration, it certainly is one of the hot button topics at the moment everywhere in the world, not just here in Ireland. I mean, you know, there are two types of people coming to Ireland, those who genuinely need our support and will pass the system and are a genuine asylum seeker or whatever, a refugee coming from a war-torn country, and they're those who are taking advantage of a system. So what should we do? Should deportation, is it really a dirty word?
No, it's not. And I mean, look, I think you've hit the nail on the head. There are two categories of people, and refugees is one of those, and they usually come through the United Nations system, and it takes a year in terms of their evaluation, and they're sort of it's processed, you know, and it's sort of distributed. So that's one that, you know, definitely that's a different category. Then you have the asylum seekers, and you know, which, you know, a lot of economic migrants. And look, you know, if people want to land here without the paperwork and everything else, my position is quite simple. We should have an evaluation process with a points-based system. We should basically, you know, look through each person and say, okay, well, why do you want to come in here? What skills you or what you want to do? And we should look at the overall character of the person, see are they a fit for society, and that's our should be our right to make that decision. You know, there's no point in allowing people into the country who just show up here and want to have a free ride and don't give a damn about our culture and what we are as a people and just all the rest of it. And it should be a fast processing system, you know, 6 months tops, treat them very well. And if it's a no, then off you go. I mean, if you have a rowboat and, you know, and you put too many people in it, it sinks. You know, so we're not here to take everybody in.
Okay. Finally, just to both of you, Marcus, I'll ask both of you this question, if you can answer it reasonably quickly. We had obviously a referendum going back some years ago in this country where, you know, we suggested the Shannon was useless. We had a referendum to decide whether we should keep her or not. Now, the general public voted, obviously, to keep it at the time. I remember at the time Aaron O'Riordan was campaigning to get rid of it, and then he eventually became a senator himself when he failed to get elected. That there is an argument out there by many people, or a feeling by many people out there, that the Shannon is just a place for failed politicians or politicians that don't get elected, and it serves little or no purpose because they can't actually legislate. They can debate legislation and put it back to the Dáil. So, Marcus, I'll go to you first on this. You know, the Shannon, does it really serve a purpose, the Upper House?
In parts of it, it does. So you're right. The old saying about the Shannon is it's the home for the retiring and the aspiring. So, you know, you definitely have, look, 54 seats there, a waste of space. They're favours, basically, for the Boyles, for party favours and rewards and all the rest of it. Those six university seats are highly interesting. You know, it enables candidates like myself to run. The idea behind the Shannon, and particularly in the university seats, was to get people who, you know, had gone on and made an effort to really develop a specialism or an expertise or skill that would enable better scrutinization of the government and the legislation coming through it. And the university seats do that very well, in my opinion. You usually get people in those seats who really take that role seriously and apply with passion the scrutinization of legislation and are not afraid to critique and call out and propose bold alternatives or amendments and so on and so forth. So, you know, for somebody like me and looking at the Shannon, and I accept that people look and say, well, everybody should get a vote. Well, then we just have another 60 seats filled with political party nonsense.
Okay.
Really, what we should be doing is we should be looking to expand that concept and get rid of more of those useless insider seats. That's really what we should
do. Okay, Addy, just finally, I'll ask you the same question. You know, does the Shannon actually serve a purpose? Because obviously they don't legislate, but they do debate legislation. So does it serve a purpose, or is it just a waste of taxpayers' money?
Hello. Hi. Could you say that again?
Please? Do you believe the Shannon actually serves as a purpose? I mean, it has been questioned over the years as to whether it serves a purpose, or is it just a waste of taxpayers' money?
No, it's not. I believe that they serve a good purpose. Bicameral system is a very important structure, and it exists in many parts of the world, especially the common law countries. It's important that the debate at their level. Like you said, you know, scrutinizing legislation, participating in parliamentary debate and sponsoring private members' bills. This is very important. For example, I mean, I am contesting for a Shannon election. I would not be contesting if I think it's a waste of space. It's important, but it needs to be reformed. It will be important that people who have professional experience, people who have professional expertise, are able to hold this role. So it's in need of reforms. I mean, we have some senators who are doing very well. If I can mention him, I'm impressed by Senator Gerald Crosswell and Michael Madowell. Mm-hmm. They have their specialty and they are doing amazing work. There are past senators who have done very well as well. So I believe, yes, it's in need of reform. It should be more democratically elected, and maybe we look at getting more experts to be more involved. But okay. I believe they are serving a very useful purpose.
All right, well, listen, I got to thank both of you, Addy Olubaroda, and Marcus Matthews. Good luck, both of you, on Tuesday. And I do apologize again, Addy. Good luck to both of you on Tuesday, and continue the good work. Thank you very much indeed to both of you.
Thanks, man.
All right, the first half of the show, as you know, we spoke to Marcus and Addy, and we decided we'd try and speak to as many people as we can. We spoke to Derek Byrne last night, And I also want to speak to Saive O'Neill. And Saive O'Neill is an environmental scientist and academic who has been very vocal about an advocate for climate action and also sustainability. And also we're going to speak to Leisha De Bruin, who is a barrister and founder of The Countess and an advocate for women's rights, women's spaces. And many of you would be very familiar as well with some of the talks that she has given in relation to that. I'm just waiting for us just to get them up on the line there. And as soon as I do, I shall go to them. In the meantime, some of the questions, by the way, coming in, people have said, Niall, why can't the general public vote in the Shannon? Well, unfortunately not. Unless you're an academic, you don't get an opportunity to vote. But, of course, the political parties that you voted for and you've given a mandate to, they get an opportunity, of course, to put people into the Shannon as well. But that is going to change. I know they are going to change the way they do it. Not too sure exactly how the changes will happen or what the changes will be, but certainly they are going to change. All right, let me go to Saive and Leisha. Saive O'Neill and Leisha De Bruin, welcome along to the show, and I appreciate both of you coming on the air. Oh, sorry, I do need to... If I switched you on, that would certainly help, wouldn't it? I do apologise. Oh. Okay. Saive, I'm going to come to you very first if I can. And it was something I said to Marcus earlier on. I'm going to come to some of you in the general topics that have been raised over the last year, certainly, when it comes to the Shannon. But in relation to climate action, and something I said to Marcus, who also stands for climate action as well, with the unpopularity of the Green Party at the moment, when it comes to, say, you know, the general election, the European elections, and certainly even the local elections, you know, they were destroyed, essentially, because people are tired of climate policy taxes. They're tired of being punished. They want to do the right thing. They want the environment to be good, but they're tired of being taxed and they're tired of being inconvenienced. So, I mean, is climate policy going to get you in there?
Well, thank you for asking me a very good question, actually. But I can tell you, as someone who coincidentally ran in a general election, so I was out on the door pushing, you know, for climate action policy.
This is for the Labour Party at the time, yes, you're running.
For the Labour Party. But this is where, you know, the sort of material issues of taxation policy tend to come up more so than in the Shannon election. What I found was that people have an appetite for retrofitting. They want public transport. They want grants that they can get their hands on easily and without too much administrative overhead in order to make their homes warmer and cheaper to run. They want all the things that climate action is supposed to offer. They want clean electricity. They want cleaner air. They want the ability to cycle and to be able to get around with low cost or even free public transport. But that is not what was happening. So if you were canvassing in working class areas, Niall, you probably did yourself, notice that that's not where the EV chargers are, and that isn't where the solar panels are. So some part of the green agenda, the climate agenda, has been interpreted as a middle class and has been implemented as a middle class luxury, when in fact it should be available to everyone. So there's no problem with the popularity of climate policies. It's all about how you implement them.
People it's a kind of carrot and stick approach, wasn't it? I mean, that's what we had. Yeah.
And you know, if you were following the policy arena closely, as I have been for many, many years, the Greens were basically implementing a kind of a spreadsheet management system that was drafted up for them by McKinsey. And McKinsey are a firm of international consultants that do this for many countries and many companies. And they basically say, right, what's the cheapest way that you can get your emissions down? Well, you need to change the technology, go with early adopters, go with the people who are willing to spend money on fancy new EV cars. And eventually that will, you know, you'll get a sort of throughput effect as the technology rolls out and the lower cost models will become more available over time to people on lower incomes.
Okay.
But people see the inherent unfairness of that. And it's a very poor political strategy when you want to...
Well, it certainly hasn't paid off for the Green Party, that's for sure. And hopefully it'll pay off in the future for somebody else who does it properly. Let me go to Leisha if I can. Leisha, you know, you're well known. The Countess is well known. You're a spokesperson for the Countess. You're also a barrister of law. Of course, before the summer of this year, I'm pretty sure whoever the next Minister for Justice is probably going to try and push through those free speech laws, which I know you're against. And maybe you could explain to people why you're against them, because some people think it's a great idea. We need to protect, you know, those people in society who may be less or who may be vulnerable from hate speech. So tell us why you believe we shouldn't push through with those laws.
Well, with hate speech legislation and particularly the hate crime legislation and particularly the hate speech part of the legislation, there was a number of NGOs who pushed very hard for this legislation to come through, but there was absolutely no grassroots support and no sort of hankering from the ground up for this, no demand for this from ordinary people. And when, in fact, you deconstructed it and drilled down into it, it was very clear there was a lack of symmetry within the legislation in the drafting of it. For instance, people with very ordinary majority-held opinions about sex and about gender, like, for example, a man can't become a woman, it's not possible to change your sex, or no child is born in the wrong body. Those sorts of opinions, which are very ordinary, everyday opinions about this topic, might have ended up criminalised insofar as, you know, someone could have phoned up on Garda Síochána and said, that person said that. And
that's, but didn't the minister didn't the minister clarify on RTE that when she was asked, for example, about, you know, whether those kind of comments in relation to, you know, gender could be criminalised, she said not at all, that, you know, that she said that wouldn't be something that would be criminalised. She was asked specifically.
I think it was a pretty flimsy guarantee when, in fact, when you look at the work of the various pressure groups and lobby groups around this issue, they themselves define hate in those terms as, you know, correctly sexing someone or speaking about biology and material reality in that regard. It's very clear that, you know, a minister's word in that regard wouldn't stop this happening insofar as the Guard's being
do you think free speech, Leash, do you think free speech is absolute?
No, I'm kind of old school when it comes to free speech. So I think up until the point of incitement to hatred and obviously Holocaust denial, that that should not be allowed. Mm-hmm. But I am a freedom of expression.
Why do you draw the line and say, we'll take Holocaust denial because you've mentioned it, obviously, the minister mentioned it too in the legislation. I'm going back about 5 years ago, I interviewed a Holocaust denier on the air. And I obviously challenged everything that he said because clearly the man was delusional as far as I was concerned. But I mean, is it not important that people who have that or hold that opinion or hold that genuine belief are allowed to espouse it once they're challenged? Is that not okay or acceptable?
I suppose I would just look at the legislative framework in terms of the EU case law around this. It's pretty robust and it's pretty clear. Mm. Everything that's happened since then is very wishy-washy and has no real public support amongst ordinary people. I mean, the other issue I have with hate crime legislation as it was drafted in Ireland and pushed through is that it really moves us away from a model of equality before the law. So therefore, if an old lady is robbed and battered, like somehow her assailant will have less of a lower sentence than, say, someone from a minority who is robbed.
Yeah, depending on the motivation of the crime. Absolutely. I want to go to Sive.
I don't think it's good to move towards a lack of equality before the law. I think we should all be equal before the law.
I wouldn't disagree with you on that. Sive, in relation to hate speech legislation, it was something that was very much debated last year and probably will be debated again in the Shannon this year. Where do you stand on hate speech legislation?
Well, initially when the hate crimes bill was going through, the hate speech part of it, of course, was in there, was kind of smuggled in, and it hadn't been debated to the same extent. There was quite an outcry from an interesting range of sources really around it, and that caused the whole issue to become debated and scrutinised a lot more closely, and the government withdrew that part of the bill.
It was unpopular, wasn't it?
No, I'm just putting it in context, which is that I think that when we are introducing a criminal offence, we do need to scrutinise that legislation proposal extremely carefully. And I accept that that part of the bill was not scrutinised carefully enough. And in fact, the debate has really caused me to change my own view. I would have been in support of it initially. And I think now that I'd be much more careful about it because I've seen what's happening on social media. And it is not just the lack of regulation on social media that is a problem. It's the nature of the exchanges that happens on social media where there is such a level of disrespect, profound disrespect, a profound lack of awareness of the impact of hate speech on people in arenas where it can't be regulated.
I mean, where do you think that we stand with the social media companies? You've just heard Mark Zuckerberg from Faces saying they're lifting their censorship.
This is it, right? So I'm kind of very interested in that area. Now, I accept that this would not be covered by the bill because there's just different rules apply in social media to the normal kind of criminal offence as it was proposed. But you are basically setting up a situation where when speech by its nature is now in a digital form so much more contested and also kind of permanent. You know, it's so much more, it's so much less transient than it used to be, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it used to be just the lad in the pub who said something.
But I think at the same time, we have to not give up our sense of solidarity with people of minorities who need our protection and support. You know, I've seen hateful comments being made at minority groups. I've heard people talking about them in hateful ways. I don't think you can legislate that to go away, but there has to be a point.
I think education is probably better in that regard. Yes, I mean,
well, I think there has to be a point where it tips over into something serious. So in the context of a crime that's already happening.
Well, we already have that legislation since 1989. We have incitement to hatred, incitement to violence. We already have that legislation
No, I mean in the context, if you're committing, if a crime is being committed, but there's this additional motive of
it's
hatred.
It's already in the law. It is already aggravating.
I accept that. Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Leisha. Well, what I was going to say was that I think that that is extremely important. But I wonder how well it's being implemented. I wonder how high up on the priority list it is for the Gardaí when they're prosecuting crimes.
Well, as Clive will know, they lowered the threshold for the test in the new legislation, which is why a lot of campaigners like myself were were trying to raise the alarm around that. The explicit intention behind the legislation was to get more prosecutions. That is not how law should be drafted. I also have a question for Saeed. She's referring to hateful comments and hateful ways that people and minorities are described online. Does she condemn the hateful comments towards women like me who are campaigning to protect the rights of women and girls, often against an onslaught of vitriol online, including rape threats? I mean, as a woman herself...
I can only hear one at a time. Sorry, Saeed, you can respond to that. Do you equally condemn the comments that we made against, say, people like Leisha, who stands up for women's rights, women's spaces, et cetera, et cetera?
I do, actually, because I think that that's appalling. And I don't think that, you can't eliminate hate by throwing hate back. It just doesn't work.
Okay, I need to move on because I don't want to focus the whole thing on hate speech. Sure. Sorry. Okay, I need to move on. And I'll come to you first, Leisha, in relation to this. Euthanasia is going to be one of the topics that will be discussed at great length, probably over the next 12 months within the Shannon. The right to die, assisted suicide, whatever words people feel comfortable use. Where do you stand on that?
If I may, I just want to just quickly draw your attention to the last comment. You can't eliminate hate with hate. I mean, I refute the implication that anything I've ever said online in any way, any of the body of work of the contest, is any hate in it at all.
Okay.
In fact, it's the opposite. It's completely cool, calm, collected and compassionate and evidence-based.
Okay.
So, I mean, if women like me and activists like me are garnering hate online, I mean, we should be able to look at it in all aspects, not just towards minority. The hatred that women, particularly women who are gender critical, face online is real and is an issue. And if you're going to take issue with one type of hatred, you have to take issue with the other, with all sorts of hatred towards
women. Okay, I'm glad you responded to that, Leisha, but I need to move on. In relation to euthanasia, the right to die, assisted suicide, whatever word you're feeling comfortable using, I mean, I know they're all slightly different, but where would you stand on that? Because that's obviously going to be debated hotly over the next year.
I have thought about this in quite some depth, and I've come to the conclusion that I do not agree with it. I think that, like so many progressive pieces of legislation that are kind of wafting through the Anglophone world at the moment, they seem on paper to be a good thing and to be a progressive thing and to solve a problem. But in reality, when they bed down, as we've seen in other jurisdictions, they do impact the most vulnerable the most. They do impact women quite a lot. In the case of assisted dying, it seems to be disproportionately women who are doing
why do you think it's disproportionately women? I would fail to understand why. Why is it disproportionately women?
I think we'd need a longitudinal study and rich quality of data in order to take a firm view on that. But I mean, we can guess insofar as, like, a lot of the advertising in other jurisdictions is quite chilling. It talks about, you know, you don't want to be a burden on your family. And I find this quite egregious that any mother who's looked after their family their whole lives then feels, oh, I don't want to be a burden. So in my last kind of gift to them, I will take this option. I mean, it's very clear in other jurisdictions, including Canada, there's been a kind of a creeping and a dilution of the sort of so-called hard boundaries and borders around this. you know, what starts off as a solution to horrific pain or terminal illness soon segues towards, depression or disability or mental illness or like poverty in some cases and homelessness.
Okay,
and nobody can stand up and applaud that. That's very dystopian. I think it's anti-human.
Okay, Sive, in relation to the right to die, where do you stand on that? Obviously, Leisha said her stall, obviously drawing attention to what happened in Canada under the MAID system, where 4% of the population who have died through the MAID system. So much so that they're now even suggesting that people who are just down on hard times or depressed can also apply for it. Even drug addicts can apply for it. I mean, isn't that the fear? So where do you stand on it?
Yes, it's a very challenging topic. We don't have a very specific proposal before us, and that remains to be drafted by the Oireachtas for the members to consider. So, in general terms, I feel very uncomfortable about it. I share some of Leisha's reservations there. So my background is actually in the humanities. I studied moral philosophy for a long time, mostly in respect of liberal political theory and climate action and environmental ethics. So I'm not comfortable applying some of the knowledge that I have directly to the case of assisted dying. But I do think that there is a kind of a sociological issue here about individualizing the sort of autonomy and overfocus on the autonomy part of a right to die, when in fact, I think we underestimate the importance of human relations. It's our relations to community, our family relations, and these ties that bind us also sustain us and keep us mentally healthy and give us well-being. Now that it's so,
if it was limited, if the legislation was limited, you know, to say somebody who had, you know, 3 months to live under professional guidance, which was signed off by three different doctors, who was terminally ill, you know, close to being in a hospice, for example, would you agree with it in that case, or is it the same as Leisha that you have a fear that it would be expanded on?
I have a fear that we trivialise the principle of supporting people in difficulty, in crisis, and people who are ill, and people who are in decline. I find it very hard to stand over another human being and say, no, you must not have that medicine, or you must not have that treatment. I don't feel qualified to do that as an individual. So I would certainly be in favour of making it very restrictive, and that there would be safeguarding in to the very highest possible standards, and that we would not allow the kind of slippage that Leisha has referred to. But in a broader sense, I'm concerned about our values as a society when we condone even the high rates of suicide and the high rates of depression and mental illness that are left untreated. And I think it's part of a continuum of how we've individualized all these problems and left people to their own devices. And a lot of people are struggling.
I know, I couldn't disagree with you more in relation to the way we treat people in this country. If our healthcare system was a lot better, we probably wouldn't need to have the discussion in the first place. All right, there are so many other topics, by the way, that I had planned to get to, but unfortunately time never is on your side in these things. I was going to get back to housing and healthcare and everything else, and I'm sure the ladies will have an awful lot to say about both of those things. Many of those things will be debated, of course, in the Shannon over the next 5 years. But in saying that, what we want to do is find out a little bit more about the characters themselves, because remember, of course, you don't get an opportunity to vote unless, of course, you're an academic and you're in TCD. You might have had an opportunity to vote. There are 70,000 people that can vote for either Sive or Leisha, but realistically, only about 15,000 to 20,000 people do actually vote, which is quite sad, actually, that many people don't take the time to vote. So I'll give both of you an opportunity around the same time, about a minute and a half each. Leisha, if you could set out your stall for us and tell us why people should actually vote for you.
My name is Leisha de Bruin. I'm a mother of three and I'm a barrister practicing in criminal law. And 5 years ago, I founded an organisation called The Countess. It's a human rights organisation and it works to protect the rights of women, children, parents and the LGB. And I never intended to become an activist, but I felt I had to take action because I could see that legislation that was supposed to protect the rights of one group would in fact harm the rights of others, namely women and children. And it was my campaigning that stopped the government removing the word woman from maternity legislation. I also led a grassroots campaign at the time of the referendum for no-no, because I could see that the constitutional amendments would in fact strip constitutional rights from mothers and recognition. And I've drafted legislation to close the loophole whereby men who identify as women can be sent to female prison, which is the current policy in Ireland. I feel like I have worked really hard to push back against all of this ideologically driven policy and law. And my track record is proof of someone who is really unafraid to question the orthodoxy and speak up for the most vulnerable. And there's a rich heritage of TCD senators who have challenged the orthodoxy of the time. And I'd like to, it would be the honour of my life to represent all the TCD electors out there in this, the last ever TCD panel in the Shannon. A vote for me, I believe, is a vote for courage, for compassion, for candour.
All right, thank you, Leisha. And Saif, maybe to give you the, roughly the same amount of time, why do you think people should give you their vote?
Thank you very much, Niall. Well, in 1991, at the age of 20, I was still a student in Trinity when I stood in the local elections. And to everyone's surprise, including my own, I was elected. So I spent 5 years on Dublin City Council as a very young woman. It was a fantastic experience and a great education. And it really garnered my interest and my passion for environmental campaigning and advocacy. And I've been working in that area ever since. So that's over 35 years of experience. I also have 3 children. And here's a fun fact. I have a daughter called Leisha, and Leisha has a daughter called Saif.
Leisha has a daughter called Saif. Okay, right. Okay, so there's a connection, a deeper connection here, I think. But go on, Saif.
I know, it's an interesting exchange, and that's what it should all be about. So I studied English and philosophy at Trinity, and I went on to study philosophy again in public affairs at UCD. And I studied for a PhD in UCD in politics and international relations. So I've been working and teaching in academia, working in DCU, working in UCD, and also presenting at, you know, in various respects, experts and liaising with colleagues in Trinity working on issues around environmental protection and so on.
Okay.
Most recently, I was active
very quickly,
in
if you can.
Defense of the Earth, and I also challenged the government in the courts, successfully taking them to the Supreme Court to quash the government's climate plan. So I am an academic and an activist, and I'll bring that commitment and expertise into the Shannon with your blessing.
Well, listen, Saif O'Neill and Leisha De Bruin, thank you very much indeed, both of you. Good luck, by the way, on Tuesday to both of you, because I think you both deserve the job. Very different, coming from very different corners, but I think you both deserve the job. Listen, thank you very much indeed, and I'm delighted to have both of you on. There you go, Leisha De Bruin, Saif O'Neill. Those of you who have the opportunity to vote, well, there you go. That's just 4 more. We spoke to Derek last night as well, Derek Byrne. Obviously, we can't talk to everybody because there's a lot of people running. But we did give the opportunity. We sent an email out to everybody on the Trinity panel because we spoke to Derek last night to give them all the opportunity to come on. Some of them turned us down. Some of them decided to come on. And they're the ones that decided to come on.
Now, real people, real opinions. Nighttime Talk with Niall Boylan.
Ireland's classic hits radio. Oh,